Begin Podfix Network transmission. In 3, 2, 1.
Fly fishing in a stream, getting those ankles wet. Or deep in the ocean, casting nets. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Fish Nerds, the show about fish, fishing, and eating fish. It's always fun, funny. No, it's usually interesting, always funny. No, it's always interesting, usually funny, and mostly true. I'm Clay Groves, licensed fishing guide, something, something, and your best friend. And John King, the crappie hippie. Who are you?
I am the crappie hippie. I am the co-founder of Glasswater Angling Lead Free Fishing and your co-host with Clay Groves tonight on Fish Nerds.
Wow. You know, you think by now I'd be able to introduce the show cleanly, but I can't.
I know. It's fine. It keeps it rustic and real.
Rustic. I like that, John. Thanks. John, I'm going to let you drive the show tonight. What's going on?
All righty. Well, I just want to start off with a story, if I may. Last, in 2021, when you were doing NAPOD POMO, the National Podcasting Month, in November, mm-hmm. I sent in a piece on bobbers. Mm-hmm. And I had the most amazing thing happen. You know, you think after 58 years of fishing, maybe I'd seen it all. Well, it's not even close. Of course, anybody knows you could fish for a million years and still not learn at all. But anyway, I'm out with Sarah. Sarah's visiting. My daughter Sarah is visiting from Massachusetts, and we want to have fish dinner. So we go down to the pond, and she's got on a little olive with a little piece of crystal flash, like a 1/64 ounce olive, under a bobber, and I'm doing kind of the same thing, except I'm going bright.
What is an olive?
Well, it's just an olive jig. Not fly rods. We're ultralight spin fishing for bluegill, hopefully maybe a crappie or a couple little bass or something. We're just trying to get enough fish for dinner. And so I put a little olive jig on hers with just a little red highlight in it, and gave her Old Blue, my favorite ultralight, and which is the one I call those perch on when I fish with you. Mm-hmm. And anyway, she just starts wailing on my behind like nothing else, catching more and bigger fish. So first thing, I'm like, okay, they don't want this crazy bright chartreuse and orange contraption I've got on. So I dig out another little olive jig. I put it on my line. I catch two or three little bitty ones, but she's still just smoking me like bacon. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's pathetic. And it finally came down to, Clay, is that I had on a cigar shaped bobber and I'd hooked it on either end, because we talk about the difference between laying a bobber down and making it stand up. Mm-hmm. And what I realized is that the swim of that bobber, when a bobber's laying down, especially a cigar type, you know, it's going to dip on each end as the waves hit it. And as or you can do your little Zara spook retriever. You make it zigzag through the water. Well, the fish were having none of that. I mean, none of it.
Didn't care.
Except for the little bitty ones, little foolish ones, you know. And so, of course, what do you do, Clay? What do you do?
Well, if someone else is having success, you mimic. Copy.
You mimic them. Yeah. That's right. You copy them, even if you have to steal stuff out of their box. Okay, so I did it. And next thing you know, I'm in the game. And I took her over to a spot where the crappie, you know, telling her about the magic hour right there at sunset. And I said, we get in here. Hopefully the crappie will swim up in there. Anyway, it was great. It worked. But wow, what an eye opener.
And that's funny, because I don't usually fish a bobber under a jig. I'm not sure I ever have a jig under a bobber. I'm not sure.
I was going to say, wow.
No, it's a little backwards there, a little backwards. I'm not sure I've ever done that.
Well, it is a very effective method, and I'm not a big fan of bobbers, mm-hmm. because they can be H-E double hockey sticks in the wind, and you miss a strike, and you're probably off for, you know, if you pull too hard, you're going to get a bobber. Just makes things wind up worse. You know, you think your lure is going to wind around your rod when you miss a strike. Mm-hmm. Add a bobber to the program.
Well, it's funny. I don't use bobbers, especially with kids, as a rule, because I find that with kids fishing with bobbers, they don't feel the bite, they don't set the hook, and fish end up swallowing the hook, and your mortality rate's just like quadruple with fishing with kids. So, with your fishing with a jig, they feel the fish and they learn to react to the strike, and it's a lot more effective tool for a lot of kids.
Believe me, that's something that I've learned, and I tell everybody, it's like, yeah, we love to watch that bobber go down. It's one of the biggest thrills in fishing, but you've got it spot on, brother. If you're, especially more than one kid, your method of using telescoping cane, you know, quote unquote telescoping cane poles, mm-hmm. Is ingenious because it really does. It lets them know what's going on by feel. In a visual age, there's nothing wrong with showing people, you know, to do things with a different sense besides your eyes.
Right.
And it prevents all that because, boy, you get three kids missing strikes and up in the trees and all that stuff. Pulling out a little jig isn't so bad, but when you throw a bobber in that equation, it just makes the most amazing tangles you ever saw.
Well, I can't wait to try that.
Well, it is a tried and true method, and like I said, if it didn't work, I wouldn't put up with it.
Well, I'm game. I'm going to be soon as the ice melts on Silver Lake, I'm going to be heading out for those jumbo yellow perch, and I'm going to try that method.
All right. Well, if they're suspended, especially, it's the way to go. You know, I mean, I don't want to get too sidetracked, but it works so good on your sunfish because sunfish tend to want to look up rather than down. Right. Sunfish tend to want to swim up at something rather than down. Now, perch, like when we fished, mm-hmm. dude, they were right on the bottom. All you had to do was pop that jig about a bot. You know, you don't want to bring it up more than 1 or 2, 3 inches off the bottom. So I don't know, man.
Oh, they'll come all the way up, though. When we see them ice fishing on the underwater camera, they'll chase that jig up 20 feet. Those, okay. They rise right up. No problem. If they're hungry, they're hungry. So,
all right. I want to get to a corrections corner here real quick.
Are you suggesting that one or both of us have made mistakes?
I, you know, it just seems impossible.
How
it seems
dare
utterly
you?
Impossible. Yeah. Okay, look, I don't want to wear out this muskie story because we've did that.
This is week three of the muskie mistake repairs.
Yeah. But I'm a fish nerd. I'm a geek. I want to dig deep and get this figured out. So we have listeners, you know, clue us in the fact that we made some mistakes in our musky facts. So about the Northeast. So here we go.
Well, I thought it was just me, John, making mistakes.
Well,
I didn't think
it's
you were.
Us, mm-hmm. Man, it's the whole team, you know, and that's another reason I want to do corrections because we got a good team of correspondents here and what gets flipped on one of us gets flipped on all of us. So, okay. So here's what I found out, Clay. Vermont is the only state in the Northeast to have native muskies.
Right. And just so people know what you're talking about, 3 weeks ago, I announced that muskies were not native to Maine, New Hampshire, or Vermont. A bunch of listeners corrected me and said Maine and Vermont had native muskies. You backed them up. Now you can finish your correction of yourself here.
Well, I'll back them up as far as, you know, Vermont, because Lake Champlain and the Missisquoi River, which feeds into it, are native muskie habitats, and therefore Vermont is the only New England state with native muskie population, and the fishery is entirely catch and release, and it is enhanced with stockfish from time to time. I hope they're using local strains for that, but I would really hope so, but I didn't get a chance to go that deep.
Yeah, well, anyway, incidentally, Lake Champlain is one of the only lakes in the country you can shoot fish with a gun as a legal method, so... Musky are on the list of fish you can shoot.
That is the craziest thing that I have ever read when I was reading the rules for that lake. I'm just like, okay, don't shoot fish with a gun. That sounds like a Kansas thing, you know? I'm just like...
I know, but you know what's horrible, John, is I want to do it. I'm game.
we all are attracted by certain horrible things.
Yeah,
I guess.
We're not going to catch and release them on that day.
Yeah, they're not going to be catching them. That's what I don't know why. If you're fishing in Lake Champlain in the Missisquoi River, you can't shoot them with a gun because that fishery is designated catch and release.
Right.
When I mentioned Maine, I was, you know, clear out of my mind. I said maybe it borders the St. Lawrence River. Well, I'm flunking geography there big time. I was flat out wrong. It's the St. John's River that forms the border between Maine and New Brunswick. And, the deal there is that in Quebec, in Lac Fontier,
Your French is amazing, John.
It is. It is amazing, especially since my grandfather was fluent. the Quebec government in the 60s put muskies in that lake, and it's part of the St. John's drainage. Therefore, fish don't sit still. They swim around, they go places, and they do things. And so those muskies migrated down into Maine, and Baker Lake was the first main water to develop a muskie fishery in the early 1980s. So yeah, they're in Maine. Yeah, they're in Vermont. They're indigenous to Vermont in the Champlain area. And, but, Maine got them introduced sort of by accident because the country next door threw them in a river that's in a shared drainage. And then finally, we tease a lot, but we're going to get this fine gentleman on this show, Clay tells me. But Lawrence Gunther, podcaster of Bluefish Radio, he remains, let me just give you a little bit on Lawrence Gunther, folks. Clay already knows all this stuff. He's good friends with the guy. But anyway, Lawrence Gunther remains a well-informed authority on the U.S.-Canadian border waters among a vast category of other, or vast catalog of other things. He produces the Bluefish Radio podcast and also appears on Lawrence Gunther Outdoors, which is produced by Access Media Incorporated. Blind since the age of 8, he has dedicated his life to helping the handicapped get the tools and skills they need to enjoy the outdoors. He is an outdoorsman, an inventor, a science interpreter, and a very active and passionate advocate for the outdoors in terms of environmental issues and making these spaces inclusive for all. If you want to hear an interview with him from back in the day, check out Clay's interview in episode 218.
See, that's a long time ago, John. And he'll be back on the show in a couple of weeks. So I've been talking to him, and we're going to get him on and interview him. And the fascinating thing about him, besides him just being really interesting, is he is totally blind, and he drives his own boat.
That's right.
Yeah, doesn't drive his car to get there, but I'm going to talk to him about that, too, because I'm like, well, it's coming, because those autonomous cars are on the way. So soon he'll be able to take himself all the way there.
Yeah, he all he needs to do is get to the lake, and then he's on, you know, he can do it, and he fishes tournaments and wins them and all this kind of stuff. He's a fascinating human being, and I can't wait till we get him back. It's going to be great.
Looking forward to that. Thanks for teasing that, John.
Hey, everybody. Crappie Hippie here, your tree-hugging redneck from eastern Kansas. And I am so excited today because I've got two beautiful young ladies with me, and we're going to talk about some fish recipes that we particularly enjoy. I got my beautiful wife, Kathy, and my lovely daughter, Sarah, here. We're all three chefs, so experience cooking all kinds of things, and we thought we'd put our two cents in on some fish recipes because this show runs a little lean on eating fish aspect of our slogan. So with it being late winter up north and already spring down south and then the whole rest of us in between somewhere, we've come up with some recipes, different temperatures, different comfort food needs and levels, and we're going to give them to you right now. All right, let's start off with Kathy. She's got a great recipe. We used to serve this in our restaurant. It's a summertime favorite, springtime favorite, as soon as you can start getting the greens and the vegetables that require it. Anyway, it's absolutely fantastic. Kathy?
All right, this is one of my favorite salads that can be eaten cold or at room temperature. Of course, I'll give a little bit of variations on it, but it's basically starts with 2 ears of fresh corn cut off the cob. If you don't have fresh corn, you can use frozen corn, approximately half of a pound bag, a thawed, 1/2 red onion chopped, 1 English cucumber chopped. If you don't have an English cucumber, you can use a regular cucumber. I would peel it, at least half of it peeled and the seeds removed. 1/4 cup of Italian parsley, or if you prefer, cilantro, and those should be chopped. 1/4 teaspoon red pepper and 1/4 teaspoon of black pepper. And just toss all of that in a bowl. And then we like to usually add a poached or leftover white fish. You know, if you've sauteed the fish in a pan, that's fine. If you have shrimp or salmon, that's also fabulous. And I like to use a soy ginger dressing. This recipe is for 1 pint. Start with 1/3 cup of balsamic vinegar, 10 to 20 grinds of black pepper, 1 to 2 cloves of finely chopped garlic, 1 tablespoon of finely chopped ginger. I do like to remove the peel. 1 teaspoon of honey.
Now, wait a minute. Do you remove the peel before you chop it, or do you take the dice and then tie it? Okay, before you chop it.
Before it's chopped.
All right. Yes, John. Before you chop it.
Thank you very much for that question.
I got to look out for my peeps, you know.
Then we have the rind of 1/2 a lemon. I like to use a zester for that. If you don't have a zester, you can use a peeler and then chop it from the peel. Juice of 1/2 of a lemon, seeds removed, a pinch of red pepper flakes, 1/2 cup of soy sauce.
Quarter or half?
I'm sorry, 1/4 cup of soy. And then combine all of that in a pint jar and fill with olive oil. And that keeps really well in the fridge for, you know, a month or two anyway, as long as your fridge is nice and cold. The olive oil will solidify in the fridge, so before you use it, you'll want to get it out, let it come to room temperature, give it a good mix, and this is fabulous, just drizzled on top of the salad. Depending on how big of a meal you're having, how big of eaters you have, you can adjust it. I would say that the amount I've given here, using about 4 to 6 ounces of fish on the vegetables, would feed 2 to 3 people for a nice meal.
Okay, so that's great. So we're talking about like the whitefish, we're talking a crappie, bluegill, walleye, black bass, white bass, something like that. But the thing I love about this recipe is it also works with the salmon, trout, fish like that, right?
Yes, and you could also even use canned fish if you want.
Absolutely. I mean, don't gasp and don't freak out. I mean, we're talking, you know, good canned fish. It's sometimes you just got to get dinner done, right? And sometimes, you know, you live or in a situation where you can't get exactly what the people on TV use. This is really good. I assume tuna fish would be outstanding in this.
Wonderful.
And, of course, a nice canned salmon. Just pick out all the little... the skin and the bones and this, and just put the chunks in there. So anyway, I'm asking questions like I've never made this before. I've done it a bunch of times, and it's fabulous every time, whether you use the shrimp, the salmon, the crappie, the sea bass, the black bass, whatever you put on it. This is a great salad that you can just have it by itself, but if you want to turn it into a fish dish, follow Kathy's recipe, and you will be happy every time. All right, up next is Sarah King, my daughter. She lives in central Massachusetts, and she is in a roommate situation where they come and go and do their thing as they please. They eat together sometimes, and they eat apart most of the time. So tell us one of your favorite fish dishes when you come home and what you do.
I cook everything about the same way. So this is going to be a lot more simple than the fancy, fun, and delicious food my mom was talking about. But
Hey, simple is good. There's nothing wrong with simple. Let's eat.
Very straightforward. I turn my oven up really high to like 400 or 425 degrees, and I get my cast iron out and put a little bit of olive oil in it, and then chop up whatever vegetables I'm going to use, potatoes, Brussels sprouts, onions, broccoli, cauliflower, any of it, toss that in the cast iron pan and put that in the oven once it's preheated for like 20 to 25 minutes. And then I just throw in whatever fish I'm gonna have on top and let it finish for however long it takes the fish to be done. And the cast iron's hot enough that the steam from the veggies keeps the fish really like moist and not dried out, and cooks it really fast in a nice way. And usually I can eat the whole thing, but it also saves well for leftovers.
Well, fantastic. And that is people's number one complaint with the baked fish, is that, oh, it dries out, it dries out, it dries out. But it's an ingenious method. It has a great cooking duration that keeps the fish moist. Plus, you've got some backup there with all the moisture from the veggies. I've had this more than once. And you can drizzle some soy ginger dressing over the top of it.
Yeah, and you can finish it in so many different ways, just like with lemon, or just salt and pepper is usually what I do. But, you know, if you're using like gochujang is that really yummy Korean chili paste that's so good. So you can make it more complicated by what you top it with, for sure.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Thank you, sweetness. All right, now it's my turn. Now, up north, we know that everybody likes to have some potato soup in the wintertime. And potato soup is one of the greatest things you can make, because you can make it with cream, you can make it with milk, you can make it with evaporated milk. You can do a vegetarian version with a vegetable stock. You can do a clear version for people that are dairy intolerant with a chicken stock. You can make a vegan version if you want. It's all good. So, basically, make the potato soup base you like. The one I like the best is just the good old traditional one. little olive oil, little butter into a Dutch oven, say about a 5-quart Dutch oven. Throw in half a diced onion, 2-3 ribs of chopped celery, 3-4 medium-sized carrots, chopped up any way you like them. I don't care, dice, disc, or do that thing where you roll them over and make the little chunks. That's up to you. And saute that off until it's sweated down properly, and then you go ahead and fill it up with the liquid, and you let all that marry and get together. And then somewhere in here, if you want, you can add a half a cup to a cup of corn.
Potatoes.
Wait a minute. Did I miss something?
You did. Where are the potatoes?
Where's the potatoes? No. This is why I need to be watched. This is why I need women in my life. Okay, right. That was soup with celery and onion. That was celery, onion, carrot soup. But now if you want to turn that into potato soup, now you get your basic mirepoix, which is the fancy name for your onion and carrot and celery. And then, yeah, you put your potatoes in, you let those work for a while and make them the size you like. I like them diced about the size of a die that you play Monopoly with, but they can be bigger, they can be smaller. It's your soup, do it your way. But let them go until they're just starting to get tender. Then go ahead, add the liquid, whatever you're using for liquid. We're in a 5-quart, so we're probably going to make about 3 quarts of soup in this thing. So about a 1/2 gallon of liquid is probably where you're going to be at, right in there. In the meantime, yeah, you have some Italian parsley ready, chopped, ready for garnish. You can have some chives if you want. You can have some green onion if you want. But here's where we can take this over and turn it into a fish dish real easy, okay? You make the main base, then you put, depending on how many people are coming to your gathering that are going to potentially eat fish, you go ahead and put some aside for the people you know don't want fish for whatever reason, and then you have one over here. And right now, there's all kinds of ways to cook the fish in this. You can put it in big chunks and let it cook for quite a while. But what we like to do is take smaller pieces, and right before we're ready to eat, put them in there, just let them simmer a little bit. And just as soon as our fork tender, then we start dishing it up, because I don't like the fish to get overdone and just absolutely flake apart and disappear into it. Kathy doesn't like it to get, you know, super, super fishy because the fish have been in there simmering all day. So we're kind of in accord on how we want this to taste and how we want the texture to go. Now, I don't care whether you're putting fish in it or not. Here's how I like to finish it off: with a big blob or slice of butter right on top, little salt and a little black pepper. Now, I don't much care to put onion and chives and stuff like that on fish, so I'm not going to finish it that way. But if I have it without the fish, of course, I'm going to go ahead and do that because it's just a natural. However, whatever the presentation, I enjoy finishing it up with a shot of Italian parsley. It makes it look pretty, and it has that nice freshness, just a nice little element to all that richness, to have that nice fresh shot there on at the end. So you can kind of gauge your serving size. I don't do more than 2 ounces, 3 ounces at the very most. I mean, how much fish do you want in this? But 2 ounces, 3 ounces per person at the most. If the fish is small enough and you've really got that base rolling, you can just lay in a small amount of super thin fillets and then pour the base over the top, and it'll basically, you know, let it sit there a little bit, and it'll cook that up in that sort of a style. But anyway, finish it with a pat of butter and a little ipar, and it is absolutely fantastic.
It's such a good soup. And you didn't mention if you like to peel the potatoes or not.
Well, we don't. We don't like to peel the potatoes. But of course, if they've been sitting around a while, or you notice they got a little green or something on them, you better go ahead and peel them. But of course, if you don't like that, that's entirely up to you. We don't throw shade on people for how they like to eat. That's not nice.
Well, all the nutrients are in the skin.
All the nutrients are in the skin, but potato chips rock. So, you know, you just can't get too hung up on it because, yes, I personally, not only are the nutrients in the skin, but there's a lot of flavor there and a lot of good texture there, at least in my humble opinion. So do it as you want it, but yes, you are absolutely have a more nutritious experience if you leave the skin on.
You could also use shrimp in that instead of a white fish.
Absolutely. And speaking of fish,
oysters.
Well, of course, the same base is used in oyster stew, clam chowder, shrimp chowder, all kinds of stuff. You can change it around a little bit if you want, but we're sitting here in Kansas, so we're going to be using crappie, bluegill, walleye, white bass, black bass, things like that. Now, catfish could work. It's going to be a little more on the fishy side. Fish from the ocean, like flounder, fluke, striper, some of those, sea bass, those are all really good in this. Sole, you got sole. Yeah, what is it? Sole, fluke, flounder, those flat things with the eyes on top. Any of those be really good in here. Also, the ones I want to try, I've never had this with burbot or cusk, but I think it would be fabulous in here because I know monkfish would be fabulous in here and is fabulous in here. And another thing that I'd like to try is paddlefish because our field tester, Birdie, he brought us some paddlefish one time and we really enjoyed it. And it's a nice, firm white fish that'll hold up well in a recipe that simmers like this. So just get with it. And once again, this is just something you're already making in your own way. Well, you want to turn it into a fish dish? There you go.
Sounds yummy. Let's eat.
All right, thanks for listening, everybody. This is Crappie Hippie and Family talking a few recipes that cover late winter, early spring, and everything in between. Tight lines and Valentine's. Peace out.
All right, look, shall we do some fish in the news?
Yeah, let's do it. A couple stories here, John. You can take the first one.
Clay, John, you know what an indicator taxa is?
An indicator taxa. Well, if you're fishing, an indicator is a bobber. So an indicator taxa is a indicator of it, that there's a taxonomy happening nearby. Yep. I'm going to stay with that answer.
It's not too much. I mean, it is there. Okay. Got it. I mean, it is. Indicator taxa are species or higher taxonomic groups whose parameters such as density, presence or absence, or infant survivorship are used as proxy measures of ecosystem conditions.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of science talk, but I'm trying to impress Doc and Amy and people that really know what I'm talking about. Unlike me, but you know, it's an indicator species. So if we see a lot of this species or that species, we can kind of extrapolate out that this body of water is doing okay, or maybe if they're not there or certain segments of their population are not in place, then we are maybe in trouble, or maybe we need to look at this body of water from a closer conservation standpoint. And I got this little article here from the University of Helsinki, which is in the non-existent Finland.
Right.
And Finnish listeners, don't get mad at me. Clay did a funny story about the non-existence of Finland.
It doesn't exist, John. I've proven it. Finland is a water body. And anyone who claims to be from Finland is from Sweden. I talked to a Swede who pretended he was from Finland on this show. You can listen back and find out.
All right. Well, I'm just going to skim this through real quick because it's pretty 101 obvious, but it's also fascinating in that this is an urban study. Ponds are an important part of urban green blue infrastructure, and they we all know the importance of green spaces in cities, outside of cities, and of course you got to have aquatic spaces in those green spaces. But when we introduce fish to catch or just to have in there, of course they're going to have an effect on other species, including aquatic invertebrates. The University of Helsinki did a story on how aquatic plants, you know, how many, what you want, how dense they should be, and so on. Anyway, they're backing up the research that says, yeah, you got to have aquatic plants in there, not just for fish to hide, boys and girls, but for the little bugs and the this and that to have a place to live and to reproduce. So emergent plants such as sedges can enhance the occurrence. They're indicator taxon was the diving beetle. And so they were talking about plants like that grow on the edge in the riparian zone or just in the water right next to the riparian zone to increase biodiversity. Now we all know bulrushes, cattails, one of my favorites, and of course sedges. I'm not sure in Europe what that exactly amounts to, but I'm sure it's a plant real similar. You just got to have these in there. If you're going to stock your pond with fish, you got to give the prey a place to, you know, breed and to thrive and so forth. So what they came up with is that the optimal amount to keep diving beetles happy and at their peak is 40% of the pond margin being vegetated by emergent plants such as sedges, cattails, pickerel weed, things like that.
That's not too much.
Yeah, it you know, it's less than half, and they say it's important not to overcrowd because you got to leave some open water for things like caddis and mayflies and stuff that do a lot of their work out in the open, and apparently you know, use different sort of environments. You know, we've got different things like mayflies and such, mm-hmm. that, you know, down in the mud and this kind of thing, and then crawl up on the stalks of cattails and sedges and rushes and things like that. So anyway, this great study was interesting. We'll throw a link in the show notes. Just saying, you know, let's not manicure these urban ponds until they just look like a pool of pond water with no plants, no nothing. Now, there are people who think that's a remarkable aesthetic, but I think it's bull cookies because you know, you got to know. And this is the point. It's like, we've got to leave these plants in here so people can appreciate the plants, what they're doing. Well, different for the bugs, but for you and me, this is what we need to, you know, people, this is what you want to see. See these plants as beautiful. Don't see a barren pond. It's just a pool of reflecting water as, you know, some sort of problem. You know what I mean?
Yep. I think you're right. So, John, I was fishing with Dave Kellum in Concord, New Hampshire, an urban pond. And it had no plants around it whatsoever. It was mowed right to the edge. And it had bass in it and bluegill and stuff, but no place for animals to hide. And I was watching a kid, like a 10-year-old kid, and he was getting bait in a leaf litter in the shallows because there was no plants around. And he would just grab a handful of dead leaves that were in the water, pull them out, dump them on the shoreline. It was full of all your beetles, and it had the baby bluegills in it because they were hiding where they could, not in the optimal place. And he was able to hand fish all these things out of there. So it matters.
Oh, it absolutely matters. And I don't want to, I'm going to leave the listeners to read this. I don't want to get into all these details about, you know, if fish are or aren't present and what happens with these diving beetles. But the point is, the overall point is something that Amy taught me a long time ago, is that if you do not have a healthy and diverse environment in your pond, then you are going to have trouble keeping up with what you want in terms of fish size, fish numbers, and so on. You can't just do that quick fix of, oh, let's just keep dumping fish in there. Mm-hmm. If you want to create a sustainable system, leave those plants.
Well, all right. Thank you, John.
All right. What you got?
I got a very short one, and I'm doing this.
I love this one.
So in my day job, I'm a DJ on the radio. I do the morning news. Yesterday morning, so March 6th, this came I got a press release from this, and I was able to get my news up before any major news channel picked the story up. So I was one of the first people in the country to report on this breaking news. And the only reason I used it is because it's so funny. That's it. But then it appeared on CNN, NBC, MSNBC, Fox News, late night TV talk shows will be talking about it. But I had it first yesterday morning at 6 a.m. Scientists in Florida found a 214-year-old mollusk, and they, you know, like just a clam. And John, how do you measure how old a clam is?
Ridge count?
Yeah, same as you would with a tree cookie. You count the layers on the shells, right? So exactly. It turns out this clam is 214 years old, based on that, which means it's been alive since 1809. Who was president? Wait, what president was born in 1809?
Abraham Lincoln?
Abraham Lincoln. So what do you think they named the clam? Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln. Yeah.
That is so cool.
He was born in the same year. He was, the Gulf Specimen Marine Laboratory said an AmeriCorps member named Blaine, no last name given, found it while walking with his family. And it's an ocean quahog, and they often live more than 200 years. So it's not an anomaly to find a 200-year-old clam, but the fact that they named it Abraham Lincoln made it news. So just by being clever in your blog post, You can make national news. Abraham Lincoln. Incidentally, Abraham Lincoln was released back into the wild. So he is.
That's fantastic.
He's emancipating the ocean now.
Exactly.
Four score and seven seas ago.
I was brought forth upon this watery continent. Yes, indeed.
We all had to memorize that when we were kids. I don't think they still memorize stuff like that anymore. But back in the day. Anyway, that's all I got for fish in the news. Let's get out of this. Wrong button.
All right, I am really, really stoked to get into this next segment now on the show. I met this gentleman. His name is Todd Correa, the fish rap writer. Through Tim Beat, my former partner on the Lure Love podcast, they got to fish together up in Lake of the Woods, and Todd got a hold of me, and we talked a little bit, and then he did an article on glasswater angling, and we sure appreciate that, because you see, Todd is an outdoor writer, and he writes for 7-8 papers there in the Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts area. If I missed one, Todd, I apologize. But anyway, all through that area. Plus, you can catch him at fishrapwriter.com. He does articles about local issues in fishing. He does articles about the environment. But mostly, he does a lot of articles giving people the inside skinny on what's biting and where and on what. So he's a great read. I pick it up whenever I can. Anyhow, when Clay called out for new correspondence, I instantly thought of Todd. He's got to join the Fish Nerds. I got to at least try to get him on the show. Well, when I put it to him, he jumped right on it. And his first segment he sent in is absolutely fantastic. So I'm going to leave it off here and let you all get to know our newest correspondent. Welcome to the show, Todd Correa, the Fish Rap Writer.
Hey now, and hello, and thanks very much for letting me be part of this pretty awesome Fish Nerd podcast. This is my first time here. My name is Todd Correa, and we here at Fish Rap Central have spent pretty much 10 years telling other people's mostly true fishing stories. And through all those years, man, I've been blessed to meet so many characters, and definitely a couple of scallywags, you know, but mostly phenomenal anglers and dedicated outdoorsmen and women. And a few of those folks have really made an impression on me. So I'd love you to meet one of them. She's a new tackle store owner named Rosie. She and her family own Rosie's Bait and Tackle in Rhode Island, and they are very quickly building a very popular brand. Rosie ties fresh and saltwater flies. She builds some really fine high-low rigs for Tautog and Black Sea Bass and Fluke. She custom builds inshore, surf, and fly rods with her father, Hugh. And somehow Rosie still finds time to paint the coolest looking quahog shells in mahi-mahi and Tautog patterns. So for a little background, I met Rosie last year for the first time when she walked across a stage at a Tautog tournament with a bomber of a blackfish. She was one of the only female anglers, and she was the only person wearing old-school checkered Vans, so you can see why I was totally impressed by Rosie. And since we're all about good people here at Fish Rap, I'd like you all to meet Rosie. So without further introductions, Rosie, please say hello to all the Fish Nerd listeners. Okay, so would you tell me and tell everyone in the Fish Nerd podcast how you started fishing?
Well, I don't remember exactly, but I feel like I just started to learn to fish. I'm pretty sure I was taught by my dad. One of the first times I went fishing, I was on a pier in Portland, Maine, and I was fishing for mackerel. And when they were flopping around, I thought they were dancing, and I danced around with them.
Okay, so I know that you tie some flies and build some rods. So can you tell me what you are doing with Rosie's Bait and Tackle?
Well, what I do in the bait and tackle shop is tying flies and building rods. For flies, I do all sorts of things. A few of my favorites are Clouser minnows and cinder worms. And for freshwater, I do woolly boogers and egg patterns. So for the rods, I can make all sorts of things. For the kinds of rods that we're making, we've mostly made surf rods and offshore and spinning.
Did you make some fly rods too?
Yes, we've made fly rods as well.
Can you tell me some of the names of the rods you've made already?
Like, for instance, I've made myself my own kind of rod called the Rainbow Rose. The reason that I name each of my, most of my rods after flowers is because, well, this bait and tackle shop is called Rosie's Bait and Tackle. My dad has a custom rod called the Fire Rose, and we're making Mr. Todd a rod called the American Beauty. And American Beauty is a kind of rose.
Phenomenal. Can you tell us if you have a favorite fish to catch and maybe you have a favorite one to eat?
Well, the favorite fish that I've caught here in Rhode Island would maybe probably be a tautog. They put up such a fight. And my favorite one to eat? The favorite one to eat that I have caught is a fluke.
And didn't you tell me that you caught a fluke on a very strange lure?
Yes, it was an SP minnow, a little kind of SP minnow called the Blurple.
Okay, now I heard that you like to fish from your kayak. Do you have any good fish stories from your kayak?
You bet. So, one time when we went off fishing early in the morning, I surprised my dad with a 14-inch fluke.
That you caught?
Yes, all on my own. I didn't even shout, I caught a fluke.
And what kind of a kayak is this?
This is a, well...
Do you know how big it is?
It is about 10 feet long.
Perfect.
And it has riggers on the sides to keep it stable.
Perfect. And you caught a 14-inch fluke.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you catch it on?
I caught it on...
You don't have to tell us if it's top secret.
Well, it is kind of an awesome trick. So, I caught it on a little minnow jig.
And that worked.
And we were doing...
Were you jigging for it?
Yeah. So, I dropped the line down to the bottom of the whatever it is in, where water is in.
Okay, right down to the sand?
I just twitch it up.
And whammo.
And then bam, it just hooked on.
Fantastic. Well, can you just tell me again about what rods you're building right now for your customers?
Well, we're almost done with the American Beauty, and we're going to make a rod for
Is this the one that you're gonna donate maybe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Gonna donate.
Okay. Now, is there anything you want to ask me? Is there any fishy type chit chat or something?
Well,
since you're the star, I mean, this is your moment. This is your chance.
The question is, what was the first fish you caught in Rhode Island?
Well, I'll tell you. The first fish that I caught was a striped bass, and I caught it on a periwinkle in Old Harbor on Block Island when I was in first grade, give or take. First or second grade.
What's a periwinkle?
It's a little small black snail about the size of a dime, maybe, or a nickel. And I broke it open and I put the meat on a hook. And I think I got lucky because the fish were coming through the harbor. And I think I got lucky and I caught a nice big striper. That was maybe five or six. So you're working on... We're not supposed to be talking about me. You're the star here. So Rosie's bait and tackle is on the way. It's growing. It's getting bigger. You're making flies. And are you taking fly orders? Can you make flies for people now?
Yes, we've got a customer already.
Excellent. Excellent. So we'll tell people to look for you on social media, Rosie's Bait and Tackle. Mm-hmm. And people want to place an order, get some clousers. The worm hatch will be coming pretty soon after Mother's Day, so maybe those orders will come in for some new flies.
Yeah.
Got it? Well, thank you. I'm very grateful you came here to talk to us. Thank you for being on the Fish Nerd Podcast. You got to be in the very first episode with me, which is really awesome. So thank you very much. And hopefully we'll get to talk to you again.
You're welcome.
My goodness, wasn't that a delightful, delightful, delightful interview? What an amazing young lady. I mean, I'm going to have a month-long case of the warm fuzzies just thinking about this. I think I can just put my winter coat away. We got to give out some thanks here, first of all, to Todd Correa for joining the show and bringing us a wonderful guest to listen to as a final high note to our 308th episode. We also would like to thank Rosie's folks for letting her come on the show. Best of luck with that tackle shop. But most of all, we want to thank Rosie for coming on and filling us in on all kinds of wonderful things and talking about her business with the pride and the excitement that comes with being an entrepreneur. Rosie, I hope to hear your voice back on this show sooner than later. But in the meantime, you keep wrapping those rods, you keep tying those flies, and most of all, you keep getting after those fish. Alrighty, this is Crappie Hippie, your tree-hugging redneck, saying you want to keep more stories like this in your life? Please check out the Fish Wrap Writer at fishwrapwriter.com. Let me ask you this, Clay.
Yeah.
Being such a busy guy and a guy that just, you know, can't get enough, just like me, do you ever have a list of need-to-dos, need-to-do chores, need-to-do things that just don't get done until some certain circumstance comes along and says, now's the time. Now's yes. The time you got to do it.
Yeah, what happens, John, is there's a lot of those things. And then things come to a head, and I'm just about to be made single, and I do the chores so I can stay married. So that's the limiting factor. If I was single, John, I would not do anything except for the stuff I want. I would just do what I want to do. I'd probably live in a condo, so there's no yard to work on. I don't like doing yard work. I don't want to fix the house. I want to play. I want to talk. That's it.
That's it?
I did two things.
Hey, yeah. that is a noble
ambition. I don't want to fix broken things.
right. Well, I just want to do a quick update on Glasswater because I have this wonderful account with the Maine Audubon Society and a wonderful young lady there, Laura Williams. She's their biologist, and they order stuff from me for their tackle exchanges. And they've been increasing their order every year. Well, originally, I just sent in the stuff in kind of a bulk pack where I put in the jig heads and then write on a slip of paper, this is what they are, and out the door they go. But as a business person, that's not so smart. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, because presentation matters.
Yeah, presentation matters, association matters, and so all that, you know, and Audubon, come on, it's the Audubon Society. It's one of the most successful conservation groups in the world.
Do you know when I met Dave Kellum, he was the director of Amskake Fishways, which was at an Audubon center, and he hired me as an Audubon naturalist. But we were the only Audubon center that focused on fish.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. So you kind of had my friend Laura's job in a way.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Well, anyway, it just all dawned on me. These are such great folks. And I'm like, hey, you're showing up, you know, to the Audubon situation, basically dressed in your work pants. You know, you need to class it up. You need to dress it up.
Where are your Carhartts?
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, put on the clean Carhartts and, you know, show up looking a little bit presentable. So I just locked down and, you know, I've been fiddling around what kind of name for the jig heads. And anyway, I branded everything. I made art for everything. I made header cards and backer cards and this kind of stuff. So, you know, my jig heads are now BizJig, bismuth alloy jig heads. I love BizJig. I thought had to bounce it off the girls, this and that, but we settled on that. Tim and I came up with King 10 for the split shot.
I like that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And then Kathy came, Birdie, our field tester, came up with Ring King for the paddle tail grubs. And Kathy came up with the slogan, one grub to rule them all.
I love it.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what I've been doing. Because I kept telling them, why is this order taking me so darn long to fill? And I'm like, well, you're having to make materials and package things all the different. You're not just doing bulk pack anymore and just getting it out of here.
You don't have minions working for you?
What's that?
You don't have employees doing this for you?
Well, what do you mean? Inside my head or out of my head? Inside my head, I have like a dozen employees. But
the reality of small business is you do it all yourself.
I have to do it all myself. So, and marketing is one of my weakest areas. I don't know that much about it.
Me too.
And, you know, commercial marketing ploys, especially on television, are just like make me want to, you know, get sick. So, you know, thinking about marketing, that job gets back burner to lure design and talk about wanting to have fun all the time, right? I just want to design lures, run out and test them. That's all I really want to do.
Right.
I have to put on my big boy pants. And in this case, my good looking big boy pants, because when you go hanging out with the Audubon Society, you want to look good. So thank you, Laura. Thank you, Maine Audubon, for kicking me in the butt and getting me to finish some of this stuff up because it really needed doing.
Hey, good job, John. Good job. Good. Yesterday, Sunday, I took some guys fishing. We went ice fishing on Lake Winnipesaukee. And it was it's gonna be a very short story, but I think you should know it was the worst ice fishing experience one could have and still live through. So the worst is when you die, but this was awful. Yeah. Two super nice guys, both pre-med students, like working on the rotations or whatever they call that thing. And they wanted to go ice fishing. They demanded to go fishing for lake trout, which is like varsity level ice fishing. But we had a huge storm on Saturday, so we had a foot of snow on the ice. And because the ice was only 4 inches thick, water got pulled up through all the cracks in the ice and ended up with 6 inches of water on top of the ice. And we spent the day just like walking through glue all day and never catching a fish, but it was terrible. It was terrible conditions. Worst.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm relieved that you were out there with med students because if someone has, you know, that's heart attack conditions, dude.
Oh yeah. Well, I told them it was no big deal.
I just, that just sounds like exhausting. All righty, Clay, we need a winner for February. You got one for me?
I do. Beth Metz has won. She's a Patreon supporter.
You know what? I think I'm going to have to jump into my customer database because that sounds awful familiar. Well, Beth, you have won a Crappie Dooler 4-pack and an Angle King of your choice. Now, you can go on glasswaterangling.com, pick out the 4 Crappie Doolers you want, pick out the Angle King you want. If you need some help from me, there's an info email there. You can hit me up there. But otherwise, pick what you want. Tell me what you want or tell Clay what you want, and then we'll get that in a package and we'll send it right on off to you.
And we do need to announce the March contest. We're doing a contest for the month of March called Lucky or Unlucky Lure Stories. All you can do is call us up at 607-378-FISH or grab your phone and do a voice recording. Email it to clay@fishnerds.com and tell us a story about a lucky or unlucky lure. And you'll be entered to win a Green Machine Crappie Dooler 4-pack and a dozen green jigs, some John Deere, some Disco Grasshopper, and some Green Hornets in whatever size you want, from 164 to 316. Again, the number, 607-378-FISH, or grab your cell phone, record it, send it in to clay@fishnerds.com. Send it all in there, and we'll get you entered to win there. And that's it. That's it. You've been listening to the Fish Nerds when you should have been fishing. Big thanks to Rosie's Tackle Shop and our new correspondent, Todd Correa, Fish Rap Writer. Appreciate that. Big thanks to John's family for doing the cooking segment. Thanks to Diane's Bath Salts for the news music. And thank you to Wally Pleasant for our opening theme. And until next time, follow the code of the Fish Nerds. Spawn early and often. Never trust a free lunch with strings attached and swim against the current every chance you get.